You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. And coming up tonight on 1A+, what happens when your local hospital closes? Jen White reports from California's rural Central Valley and hears more about the strain felt by many after one county hospital closed its doors late last year. That's tonight at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, a key factor in Kevin McCarthy winning enough votes to become the 55th Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives was the guarantee of a new subcommittee to investigate the weaponization of the federal government. Congressman Jim Jordan, who chairs the subcommittee, claims to have spoken to dozens and dozens of whistleblowers. But after their second public hearing last Thursday, Democrats and some Republicans are arguing that the weaponization of government subcommittee has so far failed to produce any evidence that would justify its own existence. But that hasn't stopped committee member Matt Gaetz from calling for the abolishment of the FBI, the Department of Justice, and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. That is, quote, if they don't come to heel. So we want to hear from you here. Have you followed the proceedings so far of this weaponization of government subcommittee? What do you think of what they have uncovered or what they have not? Have you seen any of the footage from it? 1-800-642-1234. Email us ideas@WPR.org. Sophia Kai is a congressional reporter at Axios. She contributes to the Axios Sneak Peek newsletter covering Capitol Hill, the White House, and elections. Sophia, welcome to Central Time.
Yes, great to be with you.
Let's start with the goals of this weaponization of government committee. What are they setting out to do here?
So, you know, I think this was the committee that a lot of conservatives and others affected from investigations into Russia, as well as, you know, this was, of course, was the Trump administration and any election interference, as well as the Jan 6 investigation. These folks who were investigated are looking to make the claim that the U.S. government's, you know, the quote-unquote, the feds, DOJ, other intelligence agencies, are biased in their targeting of conservatives. And that is what they've set out to prove.
So what happened at this first public hearing of the weaponization of government subcommittee?
So, you know, at the first hearing, there were a lot of claims that were made. And the subcommittee, as you mentioned, is chaired by Jim Jordan, who is also the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, so the larger standing committee that it's housed under. And, you know, and Jordan made the statement that he has spoken to multiple whistleblowers, and he used the term whistleblowers, who have evidence, you know, and these, he says, are current and former FBI officials that he says has, you know, the goods, meaning they can show that the FBI, DOJ, have engaged in these in these biases, whatever form that they come in. So he went and made this statement. And the report that you mentioned earlier is a report by Democrats on judiciary. And they've put together, so they sit in on these behind the scenes transcribed interviews. So they too are present for testimonies behind the scenes where the witnesses are asked questions by staff in both parties. And what the Democratic report shows is that none of the three whistleblowers in question actually fall under the category of whistleblowers. And in fact, at least two were paid by, you know, a Trump confidant, Kash Patel. And, you know, and they argue that, you know, it is a coordinated effort by the Trump, you know, the Trump campaign and, you know, and the Trump team to sort of influence what should otherwise be more objective investigations conducted by the Judiciary Committee and weaponization.
Sophia Kai, our guest, congressional reporter at Axios. And let's go now to the second public hearing held last week of Congressman Jordan's subcommittee. And let's hear a little bit of what took place from that committee. Here's Chairperson Jordan grilling a former Twitter executive, Yoel Roth.
FBI Special Agent Elvis Chan sends you an email. The email says this: heads up, I will be sending a teleporter link for you to download 10 documents. It's not spam. Please confirm receipt when you get it. 2 minutes later, 6:24 p.m., you respond back, received and downloaded, thanks. What were those 10 documents?
Twitter didn't give me access to my laptop, but Special Agent Chan has said publicly, and the FBI has confirmed, that those documents did not relate to Hunter Biden, and that's my recollection of them.
What did they relate to?
My interactions with Agent Chan and with the FBI almost entirely focused on what the FBI called malign foreign interference, things like Russian troll farms and Iranian involvement in the elections.
That from last week's public hearing from the subcommittee investigating the weaponization of the federal government and Sophia Kai. How did that day play out? What else did we hear from the panel and the witnesses from that hearing?
So, you know, and this exchange here is a part of a broader effort by Republicans to show that there was coordination by the Biden administration and these tech companies, and particularly with regard to the story concerning Hunter Biden. You know, that is in question. And what you hear the witness here say is actually, look, my communication with the FBI had nothing to do with Hunter Biden. And this is, of course, under oath. So that is sort of the bigger picture of what that brief exchange was about. A lot of the hearing sort of went that way. And in fact, Democrats did their homework, you know, and they dug up some instances where the Trump administration had, you know, communications with tech companies, and they played that out loud. They sort of put that into the congressional record. So there really was a back and forth. You know, remember, judiciary as well as oversight are stocked with members who are, you know, very interested in making news clips and making a name for themselves by making statements publicly in these hearings that will receive eyeballs. So you know, you did see some of that as well. You know, and we're talking about the more far right, more extreme conservatives on the committee. So, you know, you did see some of that as well.
Yeah, but Sophia, have we seen evidence? Have we heard from an actual whistleblower as defined to date? And if so, what have they said?
We have not. So we saw, and you know, and I've done a little bit of reporting here after these hearings that we talk about. And Jim Jordan really doubles down on his quest to find said whistleblowers that he's promised, and he really has this tendency to make statements and hope that his work and his investigations will be able to back them up. But essentially, he has sent out more threats to subpoena more whistleblowers. You know, right here we're talking about, you know, more than 6 or 10. He has threatened with, you know, with a subpoena again, in hopes of finding someone who actually fits this description. And in addition to that, you know, with the tech companies, he has already subpoenaed 5 of them. He has also sent 3 subpoenas with regard to school boards. So basically, we're talking about this allegation by Republicans that, you know, DOJ was again biased in its investigations of parents who have threatened as well as harassed school board members for policies that they don't like, such as, you know, teachings about gender, teachings about race. And so in total, Jim Jordan has sent 8 subpoenas to date, by per my count. Don't expect that to slow down. He has sent 95 oversight letters, and you know, and I've dug through these. Actually, more than half are basically sent to people who have signed the same documents. You know, so he is really trying to ramp up the numbers so that he can say, look, like, this is the work that we've done. And that's because he's under pressure by both conservatives, you know, and criticism from Democrats that either he's not doing it fast enough, he's not doing it in an organized fashion, or he's not coming up with results. So, you know, that's kind of the broad trajectory of where Jim Jordan is headed.
Do we have another hearing on the calendar set yet?
I believe we do. So the House is out this week. Between weaponization and judiciary, we are expecting, you know, more hearings. I don't know off the top of my head exactly when the next weaponization hearing is, but judiciary and weaponization collectively, you know, I sort of think of them as one entity. They're looking at a dozen different probes. So, you know, Jim Jordan's staff, and he has a very small team of advisors, they're looking at about a dozen different things. And of course, some they'll prioritize more than others, but we expect more hearings about the border. We expect a lot more around this idea of, you know, a weaponized DOJ, you know, and there's a few others that they've not really dug into just yet. That they might, right? You mentioned ATFs, the opioid crisis, as well as ESG, and of course, Hunter Biden's laptop.
Sophia Kai, thank you so much for sharing your reporting with us today.
Absolutely.
Sophia is a congressional reporter at Axios. She also contributes to the Axios Sneak Peek newsletter covering Capitol Hill, the White House, and elections. We're talking about the House of Representatives' weaponization of government subcommittee, the claims they've made so far, and the evidence they've presented to date. And we'll get your reaction at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And we'll continue this conversation with some historical perspective on this subcommittee. That's next on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're talking about the House of Representatives Select Subcommittee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government. We started with a look at the subcommittee's claims and weighed them against the evidence they've made public. Now let's get some historical perspective. The subcommittee styled itself after the Church Committee of the 1970s. They were created in the wake of President Nixon's resignation, and the Church Committee famously uncovered nefarious actions from both the FBI and the CIA. But the last surviving member of the Church Committee, former Senator Gary Hart, says that the agenda of today's weaponization of government subcommittee is, in his words, almost completely at odds with the purpose of the original Church Committee. Our next guest says comparisons and parallels to the weaponization of government subcommittee go back much further than the 1970s. John Cooper is a Woodrow Wilson scholar and a professor emeritus of American institutions at UW-Madison. And John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you, Lee. Nice to be here.
Yeah, and how far back in U.S. history can we go to find some parallels and similarities to today's weaponization of government subcommittee, John?
Well, the easy one, and I think one that probably people are going to hear a lot, and of course, this is Wisconsin, Joe McCarthy.
Ah.
But no, that's, in some ways, McCarthy was a latecomer to that. It really starts, as far as I can tell, right after the turn of the 20th century. Now, I'd be happy to have some historians of the 19th century correct me on this, but I think I've got this right. That's when Congress began to act more in public. Up to then, congressional committees had largely been private, not quite secret, but they didn't publicize themselves. And in fact, that was a major complaint. You mentioned Woodrow Wilson. His book, Congressional Government, has a long criticism that Congress is run by these committees that aren't accountable to anybody. And what the committees in those days would do was they would do what they wanted to do, their business, particularly pieces of legislation or something like that. And then presented to the floor of Congress, where it would get debated some, and if they had the right majority, passed. That changes in the 20th century, and it's really with the rise of mass media. Now, mass media in those days meant large circulation newspapers and magazines. It's not till you begin in the 1920s with radio, and then it takes off in the last 100 years. But before that, the earliest one that I can think of, and again, I can be corrected on this, was in 1911, a subcommittee of, I believe it was the House Banking Committee, investigated concentration of financial power. In other words, they went after this. This is a committee that its looking to expose something. It's got a, you know, it's aimed at something that they don't like, at an, I won't say enemy exactly, but something that they deplore, and they're out for publicity. They want to publicize it. It was chaired by a congressman from Louisiana named Arsène Pujot. Most of these committees would then get the name of usually the committee chair. And what they did was they exposed an awful lot of, you know, what we would now say economic inequality, although by those standards, it was something very much like today, including it found that J.P. Morgan controlled $22 billion in capital, which made him potentially the largest single factor in the American economy, even bigger than the government. So that's the kind of thing they did. Then in 1919, when Woodrow Wilson brought the peace treaty back, Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, who was chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, used the hearings on the treaty basically to poke holes in it and to find shortcomings and things that were wrong with it and to fuel up the opposition. Then another one, and you see, it can go on both sides.
Sure.
Then in the early 1920s, right after the death of President Harding, you began to get the exposure of Teapot Dome, of the scandals that had gone on there. And what happened there, even though the Republicans were in power and controlled the Congress, they didn't have reliable majorities, especially in the Senate. And a Democrat, Senator Walsh of Montana, sort of took over that committee and exposed a lot of that. Then in the early 1930s, in the wake of the stock market crash and the Depression, the Senate Finance Committee had a series of hearings about what had happened on the financial markets, especially the stock market. And it was very much, again, muckraking and expose. That unusually was not named for the chairman. It was the chief counsel, a man named Pecora, Ferdinand Pecora. That's the Pecora Committee. Then in the middle of the 1930s, Senator Hugo Black of Alabama, later Justice Black, chaired a committee that went after the utility holding companies. And again, these are pejorative. The most famous one, I think, of the 1930s was the Nye Committee, named for its chair, Senator Gerald Nye of North Dakota. And what it did, it was looking backward, but very much with an eye to the present, about how we got into World War I. And specifically the influence of, well, they said the munitions industry, but they broadened it out, financial ties to the Allies and things like that. And these are, as you can see, expose.
Yeah.
Expose is what they're after.
John Cooper, let me reintroduce you for a second here. John Cooper, yeah. Our guest, Professor Emeritus of American Institutions at UW-Madison. And I want to move a little bit because this committee, sure, the Jordan Subcommittee, seems to have or claims to have styled itself after the Church Committee of the 1970s. Do we see any parallels there from your perspective, John?
Not much. No, I think Gary Hart is right. I think that the Church Committee... The church, yes, it was looking into the sins of not only Richard Nixon, but also Lyndon Johnson. In other words, things that had gotten us involved in the wars in Indochina. And, it was to publicize, but also they had a legislative intent, very much a legislative intent. I think that's the kind of distinction we have to bear in mind. You know, if you want to get into Joe McCarthy, as I say, he was a latecomer. The House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC, was actually formed in the late 1930s, and it went after, right-wing Nazis as well as communists, but very much communist. And then after World War II, they really got going. That's where Richard Nixon, as a freshman congressman, got his start, was as a member of HUAC, and then they exposed Alger Hiss and that. And then Joe McCarthy comes in fairly late. He didn't have a subcommittee of his own until after 1952. That's when the Republicans took control of Congress and elected Eisenhower. And the interesting thing there is, unlike now, McCarthy was essentially going after his own party in power. And that's that's pretty much what led to his being brought down, reined in and brought down, was that he became, as long as from the Republicans' point of view after World War II, as long as they were going after Democrats, going after the Truman administration, going after memories of Franklin Roosevelt, that was fine. But then when he starts going after their own president, you know, he became a liability for them. One other thing that's interesting, Lee, is that these uses of it, and when I said mass media, this is still pretty much until the 1950s, you're still talking about print media. And the kind of manipulation and scaremongering that, say, the Nye Committee did, particularly the Nye Committee in the 1930s, and then HUAC later, was manipulating the print media. In other words, the chair usually, the one who's running the show, would make some outrageous charges, and the newspapers would pick this up and have them in their editions, and then they would have some testimony and everything, and the charges wouldn't be brought out. But so that would be page five in next day's paper. Meanwhile, the chair then makes another outrageous charge, and off you go again.
Well, it's very much a parallel to what we heard Sophia Kai talking about, how there are a fight for sound bites in this current government subcommittee investigating the weaponization of government. And John, I apologize. We're just out of time for this afternoon, but I thank you as always for joining us.
No, not at all. I hope this was helpful. You know, it's kind of like historians are always saying there's nothing new under the sun.
It comes back round again. John Cooper, Professor Emeritus of American Institutions at UW-Madison. It's Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. And coming up, we talk about nurse numbers in Wisconsin. Who's leaving the profession and who's having trouble joining it and why? First, do you love a good guilty pleasure when it comes to movies? That film that you enjoy even though you know it's so bad, so low budget, so poorly acted? Many people found a new favorite this February when the movie Cocaine Bear debuted to moderate box office success.
There's something wrong with it.
Yeah, I told you there was.
Why is it acting like this? Did you feed it cocaine?
No, but you're safe. Bears can't climb trees.
Of course I can!
Then why are you up here?
As the title suggests, the movie's about a bear that ingests cocaine and goes on a rampage. It's actually a dramatization of a real news story about a bear that died after eating a duffel bag of cocaine in the 1980s. It might not have been a very complex plot or even a good one, but the $35 million project brought in over $23 million on its opening weekend alone. And that's not too far behind Marvel's Ant-Man sequel from the billion-dollar Marvel Universe. It's just the latest example of an absurd low-budget movie seeing mainstream success, something that's been an important part of the Hollywood ecosystem for going on decades now. So it's your turn to add to our list of the best trashy movies. Did you see Cocaine Bear? What did you think of it? Good? Bad? So bad it was good? And do you have others for us this afternoon that would be so bad they're good and we should put them on our list? Tell us your favorite trashy movie. Call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post it up on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jocelyn Sapaniak-Galise is an associate professor and the director of film studies at UW-Milwaukee, where she actually teaches a class called Trash Cinema. She's also the author of the book, The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship in Modernized American Theater Architecture. Jocelyn, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Lee. Thanks so much for having me on. I love talking about trash.
Good, because we've got a list here, but it starts with the latest, and that would be the popularity of Cocaine Bear. What do you think about it? How does it compare to the rest of the trash cinema genre?
Well, you know, clearly audiences are really looking for something escapist, right? When we want to go see a movie called Cocaine Bear. It's kind of funny because although Cocaine Bear has this image as a trashy movie, it actually kind of had a big budget, not a big budget for a movie produced terribly recently, but $35 million, that's pretty significant. So it's kind of funny to look at that film in particular as a trash movie, because a lot of trash movies, they're really on the fringes.
Yeah, so what makes a movie, in your opinion, Jocelyn, so bad that it becomes good, or so trashy that it needs to be watched?
Well, I often tell my students there's no such thing as a guilty pleasure. There's just pleasure. I don't think we really need to feel bad about most of the things that we enjoy or most of the things that we're interested in. And as a matter of fact, this kind of trashy, low-budget cinema, it is completely entwined with the entire history of cinema. If we look all the way back into the 1920s, 1930s, very, very early 1930s, there's a practice called exploitation cinema. We hear that term and we think, oh, that must mean people being exploited, which is actually not what it means at all. It means the kind of, well, there's a few different opinions as to where the term comes from, but it comes from the idea of using advertising, which was called exploitation at that time. So really doing a lot of gimmicky advertising, kind of similar to actually what we would see with Cocaine Bear, right? Like lots of sort of gimmicks and like high profile advertising around it that's designed to get people into the theater.
Yeah, and Cocaine Bear seems to be part of a modern trend, opting for some ridiculous plots involving fantastical creatures. The one that comes to mind here is the Sharknado. It's not even one. It's an entire series. It's a genre unto itself of sharks falling from the sky. It goes back to, I think, 2013. Here's a clip from the original Sharknado.
Every time it rains in L.A., everyone swears it's the storm of the century. And even if it is, Beverly Hills emergency services are second to none. We're safe here.
There are sharks flooding the streets. And now there's one swimming in your pool.
Are you kidding? Sharks in the swimming pool is impossible.
Well, I think you can guess how that ends. Now, Sharknado, never on the big, big screen, made for TV, but how much does the medium play a role in how these movies are received, Jocelyn?
The medium plays an enormous role. So to go back to, of course, I'm a historian, so I'm going to talk about the history of bad movies and trashy movies. Going back to the moment of exploitation cinema, which I mean, it's just wonderful. If you want to see wild movies, Sharknado is one thing, but try watching Dwayne Esper's Maniac from 1934 if you want to see something truly outrageous. I mean, that movie has actual cats fighting next to women fighting, right? So it's like an actual, you know, doubled cat fight that happens on screen. It's just remarkable. But that moment in time, you know, exploitation films, they wouldn't be shown in your traditional fancy, nice downtown theaters. They'd be shown with a practice called four-walling, where the directors and producers would rent out a theater for the night or for a couple nights. They might show even in like carnival tents at the edges of town. And this kind of points to then a long history of bad or trashy or outlandish or just plain tasteless movies being shown in theaters that are like on the wrong side of the tracks, right? They're a little bit vice-ridden, a little bit outré, and that actually just adds to the mystique of seeing something that's a little bit verboten, right? And then we just like want to see it because it's in this kind of like, ooh, this slightly dirty place. Now I really want to see this trashy movie.
Jocelyn Sapaniak-Lease, associate professor and the director of film studies at UW-Milwaukee, who actually teaches a class in trashy movies. So you're talking to the expert here, and you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. We go now to Michael in Appleton. Michael, good afternoon. You got a trashy movie for us?
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. So I was calling for a couple of things. I wanted to give a mention to some of the schlockiest cinema of the 60s and 70s with some of the black exploitation movies, as well as the, I can't remember the name now, but like the Toxic Avenger. Some of those films.
Sure.
And then you already mentioned Sharknado. Some of the sequels to that are even more absurd. And then in my experience, I found that if a movie is a little more self-aware of the fact that it's very bad, it's more enjoyable often.
Oh, I appreciate that, Michael. Thank you for the call. Sharknado, not just the original, but the sequels. And there were some spin-offs, too, as I understand it. But let's talk first about the blaxploitation films. Where does that fit in the trashy film discussion, Jocelyn?
Oh, I'm so glad that Michael brought those up because they're such fascinating documents. First of all, they're like every movie, right? But especially like trashy movies or lower budget movies, blaxploitation movies are really a time capsule. Right. So if you're seeing these lower budget movies, especially from the 50s, 60s or the high point of blaxploitation, which is in the 70s, the people making them didn't have a ton of money for set dressing necessarily. Right. So you get a lot of stuff really shot on location in apartments that people actually lived in. You get like wonderful images of what New York looked at like at that time. So they function as this on one level as like a fascinating time capsule of the moment. But blaxploitation is such an excellent example of the kinds of things that trash cinema can do. And that's because trash cinema operates at the boundaries of polite society, right? Mm. It's like tasteless. It can be vulgar. It's outrageous. All of these things, blaxploitation certainly is. But at the same time, because trash cinema operates at the fringes, it can do things that mainstream cinema can't do. So with blaxploitation, even though, you know, it's not like moral cinema, right? It's not like, oh, we should follow all of these, all of the practices that everybody does in these movies. But they're movies where there's actually Black representation at a time that there wasn't, right? So they're a perfect example of how trash cinema can combine this very sort of outrageous approach with a bit of a political edge. So they're just wonderful examples.
And also, Michael mentioned The Toxic Adventure. The other movie that popped into my head when he mentioned that was Evil Dead. These horror films that are on a string of a budget and yet somehow gain, through time, over time, a real cult following.
Sure. I mean, The Toxic Avenger is, of course, a Lloyd Kaufman movie. He is the kind of more like 80s, 90s king of really trashy movies, heading up Troma Pictures that just made, I mean, the Troma movies are just like, they're disgusting, right? They're like absolutely disgusting. But he was one, he's a producer in a long line of directors and producers like Herschel Gordon Lewis, like Roger Corman or Larry Cohen, who are kind of like these amazing auteurs of absolute schlock. Right, like that is where Lloyd Kaufman operates, and I love thinking about him not as a kind of standalone figure, but as somebody who took inspiration from these other folks. Again, Roger Corman, Herschel Gordon Lewis, of course, who directs Blood Feast in 1963, which is one of my favorite trashy movies. It is trashy to the extreme. So, yeah,
Blood Feast. Let's go now to Kim in Brookfield. Kim, good afternoon. I understand you've seen Cocaine Bear.
Yes, I have seen it. My husband and I went to see it last week.
And?
Two weeks ago. Honestly, I was wondering where Hollywood's going with this. We were deceptive. It was very deceptive, the advertising for it. We just thought it'd be kind of like thrilling, whatever. I found it to be very, very gory, extremely gory. I was also a little taken back by the fact that there were like 12-year-old kids that were using language inappropriately, trying drugs. Hmm. And even though it was kind of funny that they did it in a, not the way that, you know, whatever is supposed to be kind of funny. I don't think it was funny. I just kind of felt like they're promoting some really bad ideas. And we looked at each other like, when are we walking out? And we just kind of sat there thinking, oh, it's going to get better. There might be a plot. I don't know. But and I really don't know if it was really based on a true story. I mean, none of that was really too real except for the bear ate.
Yeah, it sounds like you were a little disappointed by the film, Kim. And is part of this the marketing of Cocaine Bear, that it wasn't on the fringes, that it was on the big screen, Jocelyn?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what the problem is here, because when I teach trash cinema, we're not really watching movies that were extremely popular. They're really more cult movies. Yeah. It was something I found kind of mystifying in the marketing for Cocaine Bear, because it's trying to sort of walk this tightrope where it's, you know, it's got like a pretty good budget. It has to make back that $35 million. That's a lot of money to try to make back. So you have to bring in larger audiences, but then it's also trading on more kind of cult iconography, things like things that are shocking, right? Trash cinema deals in shock. That is its main calling card. So I was actually a little bit surprised by how this film was promoted. I think often when we come away from a movie, thinking that something was wrong with it, often it's that it didn't meet the expectations that it promised to give us. So I was a bit mystified by that myself.
We're talking about trashy movies and your favorite trashy movies with UW-Milwaukee film professor Jocelyn Sapaniak-Elise. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Kim, thank you for your call. Our conversation continues on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our conversation with Jocelyn Sapaniak-Elise. She's a film professor at UW-Milwaukee, where she teaches a class called Trash Cinema. And that's exactly where we're focusing our attention this afternoon. With us today to talk about the recent success of the movie Cocaine Bear and the long history of bad films that we can't get enough of. And we're taking your suggestions and your favorites at 1-800-642-1234, where Karen in Appleton standing by. Good afternoon, Karen.
Hi. My family's favorite is the original The Highlander.
Yeah.
Very dark as far as cinematography. You can barely see what's going on. The acting is atrocious. There's hardly any dialogue, and the premise of immortals that can only be killed if you cut off their head, and the last mortals, immortals that face off to each other, get all of the power that's been accumulated. And then they did, I think, two follow-ups on that, which were really bad. And then they did a series that was, they tried to clean it up a bit. But it's a family favorite. We go to it. We bought a copy of it, and it was still very, there was no lighting or anything like that. Everything was really shot in dark, shady hues. But my husband and I were on Netflix the other day, and they had it on, and we watched it, and they have gone back in and re-edited it.
Oh.
They lightened it up, and they added some scenes that were deleted. Oh. And, of course, the soundtrack is with, I just had it on the tip of Queen. So there's some pretty good songs. But it's still a pretty bad movie.
Karen, I thank you very much. That's a Sean Connery flick, isn't it, Jocelyn?
It is, yeah. And I thought there could be only one, but that's a Highlander quote.
Nice.
I'm so glad to hear a shout out to the bad acting of trash cinema, because that really is a hallmark, right? We really notice the unprofessionalism when we see amateurish actors. And I kind of love watching bad actors in trashy films, because they speak to the way that trash cinema breaks apart the illusion of film, right? It's like we watch something that's this bad and maybe we laugh at it, but I think one of the things that we find kind of uncomfortable, and that therefore I find actually really generative and interesting, is that We no longer are completely immersed in this filmic illusion. Instead, we're starting to see real people. And that's when things start to get really weird and confusing. And I think that's one of the really wonderful things about trash cinema.
Could we add, since you mentioned the Queen soundtrack, could we add Flash Gordon to that? That's what made me think of it.
Oh, definitely.
not the best acting there either. Let's go now to Lucas in Jefferson, who joins us at 1-800-642-1234 with one of his favorite trashy movies. What do you have, Lucas?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So in college, I was introduced to the subgenre of trashy movies, trashy like horror films or slasher films. And so my favorite was actually, it's called Thanksgiving. And it reverberates around a turkey that gets brought to life and goes about exacting revenge on people who eat turkeys.
Now, why didn't I think of that? Long before it was Cocaine Bear, it was Revenge Turkey Thanksgiving. Are you familiar, Jocelyn?
Yes, but
really?
Can I just talk about one of my favorites then? Because it really makes me think about one of my favorite.
Yes, please.
If we're in this theme of like eating and trashy movies, or like the revenge of the thing that you're supposed to enjoy, especially as a good American consumer.
Yeah.
From 1985, Larry Cohen's The Stuff, which is about ice cream that kills people that eat it. But it's so amazing because in the beginning, like, I can barely talk about this without like laughing my face off. It's so funny. In the very beginning, there's a bunch of miners who just kind of come across this stuff bubbling out of the earth, and then they start eating it and realize it tastes good. And that's just the opening of the movie. It's just wonderful, but it's also a satire of American consumption habits, right? Like how what we eat actually like consumes us from the inside. But it's just wonderful. It's wonderful. It would make a great double bill with Thanksgiving.
Speaking of double bill, let's go now to Gary in Milwaukee, who joins us. Gary, do you have a trashy movie for us?
Well, I mean, I have a question. Yeah. I go back to the 1970s for this, but I'm wondering if the early 1970s, I'm wondering if some of these trashy films were reserved just for the unique environment of an outdoor theater. I'm thinking of one in particular, The Incredible Two-Headed Transplant. It was so bad, but so good. And there's also Frogs, Phantasm. I mean, these movies, when I left the theater or drove out of the movie theater, I mean, I felt like I had damaged the way I perceived the world. It was such an experience to watch these things, and they were horrible, but I never forgot them.
And now
just for the outdoor theater.
Yeah, I'll never forget The Incredible Two-Headed Transplant, Gary, so thank you. And yeah, the old drive-ins, Jocelyn, and how it really didn't matter what was showing on the screen. It was about the event, the occasion, the evening, to just go somewhere and do something. How much do the old, since we don't see them so much anymore, the old drive-in play a role in the rise of trashy movies?
Oh my gosh, so much in the 70s, especially, right? Because you can have these kind of late night showings at the drive-in. They have to sort of fill time. I love the example of Phantasm, which is that's such a bonkers movie, and it's a labor of love for Don Coscarelli, right? It doesn't quite work, but it just sticks with you. And the drive-in, yeah, that's such an important aspect. The other important kind of place to think about for 1970s trashy movies is a kind of companion to the drive-in. It would be a kind of like smaller theater that participated in midnight movies. And midnight movies, they were shown since before World War II. This was an kind of off and on thing that theaters did, but it really became popular in the 1970s. And there's one theater in particular, the Elgin Theater in New York, that really popularized showing kind of outlandish, trashy movies, starting with like El Topo, John Waters movies, all these kinds of sort of shocking movies that they would show at midnight and advertise thusly. And part of the appeal was that you would go to this kind of like punk rock situation and meet all of these fellow weirdos, right, watching these movies together. And I think it just speaks to how much the experience of where you're seeing those trashy movies translates to a deeper memory and a deeper kind of interest in them.
Well, our technical director brought up Rocky Horror Picture Show, and that's exactly what I thought you were describing there, Jocelyn.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great example that really, I mean, that movie has had such a sustained audience for so long because of how it's shown and because of how people participate, right? Yeah. It's only partially the movie. It's so much about the enjoyment that people have of getting together and experiencing it together.
Well, Jocelyn, I believe we're going to have to revisit this on another occasion because there is a lot more trashy movies out there than we have time for this afternoon, and a lot more that people really love, enjoy, and go back to again. So I thank you so much for sharing them with us this afternoon.
Oh, thank you so much. Trash forever.
I'm with you. Jocelyn Sepaniak-Galise is an associate professor and the director of film studies at UW-Milwaukee. She's also the author of the book, The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship in Modernized American Theater Architecture. With us today to discuss why we love bad, trashy movies like the latest hit, Cocaine Bear. Thanks to everybody who called in and joined the show, and sorry to everybody who called in and we ran out of time for. I have no doubt we'll be revisiting this on another occasion.